All right, guys, we got a special guest here today, Reese Johnson. Reese, how you doing?
Oh, not too bad.
Good. Ryan's joined us as well.
That's right.
Reese, tell us a little bit kind of what you do, your day-to-day, all that good stuff.
Yeah, so I'm a full-time real estate broker, and so that keeps me busy. I'm licensed in Tennessee, Kentucky, and just added Illinois. And so selling hunting farms is what I like to do when I get to do it. And I do plenty of houses and commercial as well. So that just keeps me on the road and on this phone.
Good deal.
I'm sure of it.
Do you do any land consulting or anything?
Not on a, you know, professional level, just from experience, you know, and it's something I've kind of toyed with, but not really gotten into, you know, as far as formal. I'm busy enough, you know, we've got three kids and all that keeps me going and trying to find time for myself to get in the woods and might be something we look into down the road, you know, something that what kind of got me into all this, you know, is my dad. You know, he went to Mississippi State and got his master's down there from the deer lab. And so that and his job, you know, is kind of what got us where we are today. Mm-hmm. And then taking that and ran, which he's just retired this past spring. So that's hopefully maybe going to open some opportunities for him to help me maybe or open some new doors, try some different things. So mm-hmm. that's definitely a thought.
And he was over at Clark's River Refuge, wasn't he?
Yep. So we've done the National Wildlife Refuge System, been in Georgia, Mississippi, Arkansas, Kentucky's where we finally ended up. And that was back 2004, I think. We were not, the plan was not to stay here, but we liked it too much. And so it's just where we're at now. He retired out of here. And you know, of course, now I'm married with three kids. My sister, she's married, three kids. And you know, this is home now.
What's the market like right now as far as like recreational land? Is it like a buyer's market or seller's market right now? What is it?
Well, the market has definitely softened up a little bit. You know, it's not like it was in 21 and 22 even. And so, you know, with rates being a little higher, everything just being so much more expensive, inflation and such that, you know, there are, I'm not going to say bargains. I mean, there's always a bargain, but, you know, it's definitely not what it was back when. You know, and the thing about land in general is, most of the time, the buyers don't have to buy and the sellers don't have to sell. Mm-hmm. And so you get a lot of folks who are, well, if I can't get what I could have got back then I'm not interested in selling. And it's, you know, so finding that perfect combination situation where the dollars make sense for everybody and the investment makes sense, you know, that's become a bigger mm-hmm. challenge as time has gone on and we've gotten into this market. But, you know, from, gosh, when we were in high school and all that, I mean, prices have come up significantly.
Yeah,
of course.
We had Bill Winkie on a couple of weeks ago, and we talked about how he flipped the recreational land in the early 2000s. And at that time, I think he told us it was like 325 an acre in southern Iowa.
Oh yeah.
And but curious from a real estate perspective, do you think it's still, is there properties out there you can find that you can still do a timber harvest on and still make decent money and flip land that way?
You're not going to pay for it. You know, I get a lot of folks who think that, and land finances differently as well. And so not only do you have the, you know, the good old days of back when you could have, you know, done those things and really done well, you know, the internet, I think, and then just the knowledge, you know, between the podcasts, the YouTube videos, all the information that's available, you know, it's a readily accessible. So the folks who were in that game did well when they knew what maybe not everybody else knew.
Yeah.
And so now that information is out there, he's like, yeah, you know, it can help you make a few payments. So you might cover your taxes, but you're not generally going to pay for an entire property anymore with timber and tillable.
Yeah. The sellers are just so much more educated and.
Right. Right. And then in real estate agents too, which I mean, there's a lot of them. That doesn't mean they're all very good, but you know, so that's where, you know, as a seller or a buyer, you know, it's your right and you better be informed on who you're hiring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you hunt mainly public land?
I hunt anything and everything I can get my hands on. So I've got permission pieces. I've got farms that I pay to lease. And then I've got plenty of cameras and hunts planned on public as well.
How many cameras are you running?
I'm a little down this year. Probably 80 to 100 in that window.
Yeah.
I bought a whole bunch. My stockpile's getting a little less and I need to replenish it. But
yeah, yeah. They don't last super, super long.
No, it doesn't matter what it is. And between them getting messed with and something I learned, we went out to Kansas not like 2 weekends ago. Got a farm out there we're going to be hunting this year. My dad and I both drew tags. And so we picked up a lease out there from some folks, friends of a friend kind of deal. And went and set up feeders and put out cameras. And I'd already been out there once to just learn it, meet the landowner, see if it was something we wanted to do. So we went out there and set it up, you know, for him and for me. And something that I did learn is that I like to run my cell cams off of 12 volt batteries, you know, a little power cord that goes to them. And I think it's the pack rats. They really like to chew on those cords. Because yeah. I was in July and I had four cameras on battery boxes and three of them were dead within a week. I was like, what in the world's going on? Yeah. That don't make any sense.
Yeah.
I get out there and every single one of them had been chewed.
That's wild.
So something we don't deal with here.
Yeah.
Never would have thought it.
What, I got drawn for my out of state Kansas tag this year too. And my deer have like big deer disappeared in the last month. Like, has that happened for y'all too? We're in Northeast Kansas, so it's probably
We're Southeast. I mean, probably not too far, but, you know, I mean, I don't have a ton of intel. Mm-hmm. That farm is what really killed us, particularly out there this year, is that, they had wheat in and they didn't get it cut till late because mm-hmm. it was so wet and it was so late that they didn't double crop beans. So mm-hmm. I don't have any food. So I don't have any deer.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they're showing up, you know, I'm getting new bucks mostly every night mm-hmm. right now. And so I'm every night, you know, waking up at 3 a.m.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I think our problem was it's been so warm. I mean, our farm is still surrounded by standing corn that they haven't harvested. So that's where those big deer are still bedded in my opinion.
Yeah. And there's a lot where we are. It was, since it was mostly wheat, there's no corn really within a 2 or 3 mile radius. It's mostly all beans, mm-hmm. but that's where the deer are. Now there's a couple, we found a couple of acorn trees dropping that they're tearing it up. And so I haven't, we've got some pretty good deer, but nothing that I'm, you know, prepared to get in the truck mm-hmm. and drive for tomorrow anyway.
Yeah.
What's your thoughts on regulations for trail cameras? Obviously that's been a big topic over the last little while. That I know it was thrown out there for Kentucky and a few other states.
Yeah, I'm not a fan. I want to run my cameras. And really, there's the two main points that I would give is one, you know, and this is something, you know, my dad dealt with as the manager of a refuge. You know, his argument was that, you know, and it has changed a little bit now that we have cell cams. But back in those days when it was a topic, it was more of a, you know, if you're not smart about how you access and you're checking those cameras regularly, you know, you're leaving that scent and you're giving the deer as much of an advantage versus going in random.
Yep.
So that's one thing that, you know, I would say, you know, it definitely put some pressure and don't get me wrong. I'm out there on public and it's like, I find a scrape. My initial reaction, start looking around. It's like, where's it at?
Yep.
You know, cause I'm fixing to get my picture to it. But you know, it's one of those things where, you know, bird watchers and hikers and, you know, it can be a hobby for some. I know some guys that like running cameras more than they do hunting, and I might fall into that category. Yeah. But to me, it's one of those things where I, especially being Kentucky in a one buck state, you know, I want to build that history. I want to know that I've had that deer at 2, 3, 4, 5. You know, there's a deer on public land. I made a post about it not too long ago. I've had since 2019.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he survived from 2019, you know, and it's the same vicinity. I mean, I'm pretty confident it's him. That deer's 9, 10 years old.
Yeah.
And still making it.
Well, that's my thing. Like, I feel like, you know, I love to deer hunt regardless, but cameras have kind of helped me get to that next level of being invested into it. You know, got a wife, got a kid, got job, all that kind of stuff. It's a way for me to kind of connect to the woods that I'm hunting when I'm not able to get out there. Obviously there's nothing better than sitting in a stand, but to be able to have that connection when you're not able to get out to the woods, I think it's just unmatched.
Well, and I think another thing is it gives hunters hope. It's like, hey, I know that I had a picture of a 150, 160. You know, he may not be regular. He may live on the neighbor. He may come through once, but it's like, I may not be as quick to settle for that 3-year-old.
Yeah.
You know, and I, you know, it gives you a chance to build the history, a chance to hold out and feel good about like, hey, I'm waiting on a particular deer. I know that he's here. I don't have to shoot that deer. And then that helps us, you know, helps everyone when the quality gets better and the age structure is better. And that's the big battle today is, you know, we want age because age equals antlers. It doesn't matter where you're at. And so finding the balance of regulations and what everybody wants and still having a good product out there, because in the end, it doesn't matter. Big deer or what sale licenses, big deer, what get people out there. And, you know, if the motto becomes, you know, if we could become a 2-buck state, you know, that's gone generally. Yeah. You know, and then they will not have the participation, the revenue, the folks who, you know, Kentucky will not be one of those states. So that is a big fear for me.
Yeah.
We used to get 1 buck tag public and 1 private.
LBO was a bonus buck, and then Peabody, okay, I think, was a bonus buck.
Yeah, and they took that away, and that's really, you know, increased the quality on both of those, I would argue.
Oh, yeah. I'm probably going to make some people mad when I say this. I wish they would push gun season back to December.
Oh, yeah.
In my opinion, I think we would have just as big as deer in Kansas, maybe not Iowa, but it would be pretty close.
Any Midwestern state that's willing to do it, and obviously there's a lot of political challenges to it, and that's really the big thing is, you know, you're fighting against the insurance money as much as anything, and then the disease side of it. But yeah, any state in the Midwest that's willing to follow Iowa's example, and Iowa could even be better, but it doesn't matter if you know, moving your gun season out of the rut, going from rifle to muzzleloader and shotgun, you know, becoming a draw state for non-residents, you know, any of those things would make a massive difference. And that, and so what has kept Kentucky as good as it is just simply the fact that it's a one buck state.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at Illinois or Indiana, you know, they're better, they're bigger. And not everybody does shoot two bucks, but you can get them. Mm-hmm.
The hard part about that, I feel like, is we have such a high population of deer. We've got so many does, and honestly, we've got too many does in this area. And so we need to, it's kind of like a happy medium, because I know from Fish and Wildlife, of course, they want more does killed. They added that September antlerless only season this year for rifle. And, you know, they're kind of fighting that battle as well. You know, how do we get more people to take more deer to balance our herd? Because we've, in my opinion, we've got an out of balance herd. You know, we've got way too many does per buck, and, you know, that's difficult to navigate.
Yeah. And, you know, you look back, you know, 20, 30 years ago, the thing was, you know, you didn't shoot does.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, there was a time for that, but yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. And so, you know, and it is hard, because it's like, you know, we're going to Kansas and we've leased a farm, you know, I'm not going out there to shoot does, you know, and that farm, I don't have time. I get to run out there and hunt it for a week or two. And, you know, yeah, deer, you know, does need harvested there as well as they do here. Mm-hmm. And so you're finding that balance, you know, is the hard part, because, you know, reducing the deer numbers would make the state happy. It would make the insurance companies happy, but, you know, harvesting or shooting does is not popular.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So that is the hardest part, is convincing people and getting them out there in some form or fashion. You know, if it's me, the antlerless seasons are fine. I'd much rather have that in December.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I'm not trying to be out there in 90 degrees.
Getting ticks and fighting snakes. So, and
that would be more my thing, but
yeah,
that's, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause Iowa, a landowner tag, is it $2 or $3?
But, you know, if you have a landowner tag, then you can have up to three as a landowner in Iowa. So, you know, that's an argument. It's like, why does an Iowa resident need three? You know, that's their decision, but they're taking care of their residents, you know? So if anybody should get that, I commend them for that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we're down here where that's not, you know, we don't have that. And so, you know, but now you're looking at, for an archery tag, 6 years, 6 points. And that point creep's just going to keep going.
Yeah.
So I've personally, I'm not waiting 10 years to hunt Iowa. I'll just go with a gun, muzzleloader, a gun, and, you know, just is what it is. I'll hunt public or whatever I can do. But I'm not, you know, I want to hunt it as many times in my lifetime as I can.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think this was the first year I put in for my Kansas one. And from the people I've talked to, is it's like an every other year thing in Kansas for archery.
It depends on the unit. It should be. I went out there in 21 and 23, and I went a little further west, and I hunted public both times and shot deer both times. One was a 5-year-old and one was a 3-year-old. Mm-hmm. You know, and they were both mid-30s deer that you're hunting public, you're sleeping in your truck, you're driving hundreds of miles from piece to piece to piece to figure out which, and I love it. Don't get me wrong. That's my favorite hunt. So I told my dad, I was like, for me to give that up, because this was our year to draw, you know, it's like for me to give that up, you know, that was hard.
Yeah,
but we did it, and so we're gonna see what happens. But yeah, I mean, generally it's every other year, but there, you know, some on the eastern half, I think the percentages are a little higher to be able to draw every year.
Mm-hmm. From a real estate agent perspective, if they were to move gun season back to December, I mean, the market would fly, and I mean, because this is one of the few states where you can kill a big deer in velvet in September.
Yeah. And I think that would, you know, if you eliminated that, I'd be perfectly fine if deer season started October 1st. I'm just not a huge get out the early fan, you know, but that is a draw. And so, you know, that balance is hard. But if you did something to make the age structure better, then yeah, you know, Kentucky's Game and Fish, I forget the percentage, 84-86% of their budget comes from license sales.
Yeah.
So my fear is that, you know, as quality continues to decline, if that is the case and we continue to, you know, sell more licenses and bring more people in because they need to continue to increase the revenue, at some point that's going to tilt over. And then, you know, the return on that's not going to be the same. And so, and then by then it's going to be a long cycle of, oh, we're not getting people to come here because we're not a destination state anymore.
Yeah.
And so there will be a day when that starts to decline. And then you still got the balance of trying to get more deer killed. And that's their thing is, you know, extend the season, add more opportunity, lengthen the gun season to meet that number. But at some point there's going to be a tipping point. Mm-hmm.
What have you seen in LBL the last few years? Is there more out of state guys hunting LBL?
The public craze has taken over.
You could thank the hunting public guys on YouTube for that one.
Yeah. And you know, it's one of those things where it's everywhere. But yeah, I mean, the pressure has gotten significantly in all states, and I'm doing the same. I've got cameras in Illinois and Kansas and Missouri and here and just wherever I can go to try to, you know, have an opportunity. And some, and I may make it this year and I may not. But a lot of that, I go up there and I let them. I leave them soak. I'll go up there and shed hunt, and I'm just, you know, on the off chance I do kill a deer in Kentucky early for once, I might have a window where I can sneak off to an over the counter state. Mm-hmm.
If someone, you know, let's say, you know, someone's going to take a vacation and hunt the rut, whether it's in Kansas, and it's probably different for Kansas. Let's just say Kansas as an example. What is your favorite days in November to hunt the rut?
So, yeah, Kansas is a little different for me in the sense that I want to be out there when it's cold. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember that one night it was 9 degrees. I was sleeping in the truck. It was not fun. But, you know, I want to be out there. And Kansas, to me, was a little different. I was far enough west in that situation that I was hoping to find them in lockdown so I could maybe do a spot and stalk. Mm-hmm. The train really didn't. There was a couple. I had one good opportunity I found on a bedded buck. And I'm like, I see him. I figure out the wind. I'm driving this section. Pop over the hill. And I'm parking here. And I get over the top of the hill there. And there's two guys standing, one with a bow and one with a camera. It's like, okay, well, I'll just move on to the next one.
Yeah.
So the opportunity, you know, but out there for that reason, being in lockdown, especially on public, you know, I've gone out there a little bit later. You know, basically I'll be here and I'll hunt our opener and then I'll leave Tuesday and then I'll be gone Tuesday through Sunday. Mm-hmm. So that being the case, I would rather be out there when it's cold. And then, you know, here for most places in the true, I hate to say Midwest, but you know, this side of things, that it is hard to beat that first week of November if you've got the weather. Yeah. But you know, nowadays I remember what 3 years in a row we had the gun opener, it was snow.
Yeah.
And then it was last year, the year before, it was in the 80s.
Yeah.
So it's just so hard, which works for my schedule. I can kind of tweak it out a little bit to where I need to.
I feel like I've had more success seeing daylight activity from mature bucks on Halloween weekend here the last few years rather than actually November.
Yeah. And that's one of those things. If you can find that scrape, you get in there, you know, scrape week, as you know, it's become known, that is a fine time to get in there. And if you can figure out where he's bedding, what scrape he's wanting to work, you know, right before dark and get in there. You know, that 25th through the 31st is a prime time to do that. And this year's looking like we may have some decent weather. So we'll see. But it's been a little weird. I don't know if there's enough acreage on the ground or what's going on. I feel like they're a little behind on scrapes, or maybe I'm just anxious. Mm-hmm. But they're starting to finally show up. I mean, I had a couple new deer show up last night working scrapes I've had cameras on since July. And yep. Nothing's touched them. And then here they come.
Yeah, that's kind of same. What I've seen is, I mean, it's really overall been pretty slow, you know, to where you normally like start getting into the beginning part of October and start seeing some deer starting to show up. And, you know, you can tell they're starting to do different stuff. And it just seems like that first 2 weeks so far of October has been a little bit behind. And now I'm starting to see some deer moving, staying on the feet.
We took the kids out this weekend for youth season and we struggled.
Yeah.
I mean, my boy, he shot his first deer Saturday morning. So that was the highlight. But, you know, getting a buck for either one of them, and granted, they're not picky, but just getting one on their feet in daylight. And I have got blinds and cameras and corn, and I have been trying to just find a consistent anything. Yeah. And it's been a struggle. This year has been hard for whatever reason, even with the corn.
Yeah.
Which I'm not afraid to admit.
I've been blaming it kind of on the acorns. It seems like every big oak tree you see has got a bunch of acorns on it dropping. And that's the only thing that I can guess. And where I hunt, we've got a bunch of cows out there too. And, you know, they have been in the woods more than they typically are this time of year. And the only thing I can attribute that to is more acorns too.
And you know, two different spots that we hunted with the kids, that I hunted with, one my daughter and one my son, you know, we had feeders, corn, mm-hmm. and we saw deer and they were just walking by to go eat. Cause there was, it was funny. Cause you know, we'd hear the acorns, they were raining, just raining. And then every time one would drop, you know, Jeremiah would be like, oh, there's a deer coming. No, that's acorns. Yeah. But they went out there, they fed, we saw them. But they didn't have any interest in that.
Yeah.
In that corn.
Well, you mentioned the corn pile, which, they lifted that baiting ban, what, 2 years ago?
This year is the first year. But it's got to be, can't be a gravity feeder or anything like that. It's got to be spread.
Okay.
Broadcast.
So what, and I need to be more educated on this topic, which is why I'm asking you, and you walk a lot of properties with real estate and stuff. So what exactly, which one is more detrimental, EHD or CWD?
Oh, you're going to get me in trouble here. Visually, it's EHD. You know, I mean, that can wipe out a herd in a hurry. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's really nothing we can do about it. What I hate, and maybe it's happening and I'm not aware of, is just the lack of funding and the lack of research and the interest in figuring out anything as compared to CWD.
Yeah.
You know, and so they're putting a lot of dollars and a lot of effort into that and you don't hear anything. And I'm sure somebody out there somewhere, but to what degree is it 10 to 1?
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, I have my own problems with CWD as well, but that's an opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I mean, EHD has been a problem in Iowa and the Midwest for many years. And have they made any progress on anything?
You know, there's a lot, I think mostly, you know, it's out of our control. And like this year was a prime EHD year. You know, I found one of my, assumingly would have been target bucks for somebody, 4 year old deer. I had pictures of it 2, 3, 4. I was over there bush hog and I could smell him. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't even bother with it that day because I didn't want to get covered in ticks and then get back on the tractor. So I came back a different day and it took me a little while, but he was in the creek, you know, probably 135, 140 inch 10 that, you know, a deer that I knew well and I'd had pictures of up until that point. And so we got hit with it pretty hard, I think, here and a lot of places. And it's hard to say really just how bad. We really probably won't know until shed season, until we start walking. I mean, my number one target buck last year, he was on public and he was traditionally a deer that would shift and show up that first cold front in October. And so I had some opportunities at some other deer that I, looking back, should have, you know, tried to hunt and I didn't because I was waiting. I was waiting and he never showed up and he was like clockwork. He'd done it for 3 years in a row. This was year four. Mm-hmm. And so finally I got a little anxious in late January and went for a walk and it didn't take me half a mile.
Yeah.
First thing I found.
Yeah.
You know, and you could tell a lot of people, you know, whether it's EHD or whatever you want to say, I mean, those deer that die early, you know, they have those real sharp burrs on there and they don't have that same coloration or maybe they're a little frail. And so it's, you know, to me, that would have most likely been EHD.
Yeah.
When you say a prime EHD year, is it just because it's been so dry?
Yeah. So dry, you know, and then what that does is limits the water holes. Mm-hmm. And then those midges, you know, they get in the mud and those are the ones that bite the deer. That's the way I understand it. And so, you know, when we have a drought and there's either a late frost, you know, frost is what will kind of end it. And so if we have a dry year where they're concentrated and there's a lot of exposed mud, that is, you know, the kind of years that heighten it. And this was, you know, a prime year for that reason.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been as dry as I can ever remember it in a long time.
Yeah, it just seemed like to me the no baiting ban on certain counties when they were trying to do CWD just didn't really like make sense to me because, you know, you could have one property in one county that you can bait and then 100 yards over here, the property line, he can't, but it's the same deer using the same property. So it just didn't really make sense to me.
Yeah. And like I said, I mean, I'll touch on that a little bit and try not to make too many people mad. You know, I'm not a big fan of the way that they have treated it so far. I think I will. You know, commend Kentucky for allowing baiting back. And the reason I say that is that Kentucky, especially where we are, it's been, you know, we don't have sections. We don't have big chunks. It's been chopped up and chopped up and chopped up to the point where my fear was that on folks who may have 10 acres where they live and they might go out and shoot, you know, have a corn pile and shoot whatever comes in. And that's just how they hunt. And that's okay. But when you lose those people because they can't bait, or maybe that's just all they know, you know, you're not going to see the harvest that you want. And the point with them, with CWD and all these additional things, is to harvest more deer. And so my fear was that they were going to say, well, you guys didn't do your job. You didn't shoot enough deer, so we're going to bring in the sharpshooters. We're going to do also the things that some other states have done, and we're going to reduce the population. And so, you know, for them to allow baiting, I don't know of any other states that have done that so far. But I'm, you know, hopefully we will see an increase in harvest that'll make everybody happy and get some folks back in the woods on those small pieces that didn't. So I can live with that. You know, I don't know. There was a podcast on Meat Eater with the Chamberlain, I believe, on CWD not too long ago. And, you know, the way that they presented that, there was definitely some things that I didn't know. And it was a lot of good information. And I think it's been out 2 or 3 weeks now. But, you know, there's still things that my biggest fear is that is the knee-jerk reaction by a state agency to say, hey, you know, it's here, it's detected for the first time, we got to wipe them out. Yep. And is that the best solution? And if it's been around for that long, you know, I mean, obviously populations where it's significant, they're showing declines. But at some point, you know, will Mother Nature, will they, you know, have some immunity to it? Will that become on, you know, will that show up? You know, what is the absolute worst case scenario? Do we lose them entirely? You know, where do, you know, obviously whitetails are extremely adaptable and they can figure it out. And so that's my big fear, was that doing something so quickly, so dramatically, that might affect, you know, the income for that state, the draw to that state, whichever one it was. And so it will be interesting to see. But, you know, I will say I'm not a fan of everything, but I do appreciate the so far the way that they have treated Kentucky wise to get us to this point. And then we'll just, you know, we're just going to have to see from here.
A friend of mine's a biologist for Kentucky Fish and Wildlife, and I've spoke to him about it some. And from his stance, the biggest thing that they're worried about in the state of Kentucky is the elk population.
Yeah.
Because they've spent so much time, so much money over the course of several years to build that population up. And I'll be honest, like, this is just my opinion. I don't think we really know all that much about it. Even the biologists, I don't think they don't, they, it's all kind of new, what they're learning, you know, as they go. And so I think they may just be scared and precautious. Obviously there's a lot of money invested into it as well. So there's probably some other factors there.
Yeah. And you have to be. So, I mean, I don't discredit that at all. I mean, yeah, you've got to do that. I mean, that 5-year study they finished, you know, that they were talking about in Northwest Arkansas was really interesting. You know, they're saying now it's so prevalent that the deer per square mile is 1 to 5.
Yeah.
And they're expecting that, you know, over 50% of the bucks harvested will have it, you know? And so it's just one of those things of it's probably not ground zero, but that's one of the, you know, further advanced populations to where what happens there could happen here in 20 years, 50 years, or it may, you know, we may never see it. Yeah. So it's interesting to keep eyes on. And so, you know, my thing is just, let's not, you know, right now, I mean, with the knowledge and the information and things that are out there, you know, this is the best, you know, whitetail hunting has ever been.
Yeah.
And I don't want to run in there and just ruin it quickly over a fear and not knowing. And that's the thing I don't think about, you know, that I'm afraid, no, you know, that's not being taken into account is, you know, big deer equal big dollars.
Yeah.
And if you go in there and you wipe that out out of just being precautious, you know, where is that balance? And that's really kind of what I would, you know, feel better about, you know, having some answers on and approaching it in, you know, that way.
The one thing I wish that and we as hunters could all be a little bit better about this as well, but with Fish and Wildlife, everything is educating even just the public on what CWD is, what EHD is, because here recently, I know I've seen, and it's been a pet peeve of mine, so many people that don't know the difference between EHD, CWD. And I don't know if you saw on the news the other day, there was a deer that went into a school and everyone jumped to the conclusion, oh, that must be CWD. Well, I'm not a biologist. I don't know the most about it. However, the deer that I saw didn't appear to have CWD. Generally, they'll be malnourished, all that. And we're in a drought year, probably EHD, if I had to guess. And I've seen several people post pictures of dead deer next to water. Oh, this CWD is terrible. Well, we don't know that it's CWD. No one talks about EHD enough, I don't think, compared to CWD.
Yeah. And, you know, and that's just because of the funding and the things that you have to do when you shoot a deer in a CWD area, you know, and, you know, bringing it back across state lines, you know, if I shoot a deer out of state, well, generally, if I'm not getting a skull capped, and I want to have it euroed, you know, or something to that, you know, I'm going to have to hang around, wait a day or two before I can bring it home.
Yeah.
You know, and there was a, you know, that happens in Kansas where that one day where I dropped it off and I stayed an extra night and waited before, cause I want, it wasn't big enough that I wasn't going to mount it, but yeah. I wanted it Euro'd. So I left it and, you know, I'm 10 hours from home, so I wasn't going back for it. And so, you know, you just had to factor that in, but you know, that's exactly right. And it's hard. And the same thing can be said for, you know, like for the agriculture sector, you know, people are so disconnected nowadays. Where does your food come from? What goes on? You know, and I do have that opportunity to talk with a lot of, clients or people, you know, a lot of them are, you know, or even they're just regular folks buying a house, you know, it's, you know, I'll, you know, we, cause it's going to come up, you know, hey, I'm, you know, I'm going to be gone next week. I'm going hunting. Sorry. So that sort of stuff does come up, and that's where, you know, you just have to, you know, and so it's like, I generously probably too much give away a lot of the meat that we have, you know, I mean, and that's one of those things I've always explained to people, you know, it's like, well, you know, I had deer once and it was bad. So well, if it was not good, then to me, it was just not taken care of properly. It was not processed well. Maybe you got it, you know, took it somewhere and you got a mixed batch of something, you know, or somebody, you know, and that's why we do all of our own. And that's the stuff that we give away. And I always emphasize it. Look, hey, generally, our family will put away 6 to 8 does. A lot of times I'll donate the bucks, and that's just usually because November's busy. Maybe my daughter shoots one, dad shoots one. Like, I'm not trying to process deer right then. I'm trying to keep hunting. I'm going somewhere else, hopefully. And so, you know, around Christmas time, first year, things are a little slower. So usually over those mid-December time frame, we'll stack up 4 or 5 and then process them at the same time. But I think we put up 128, 130 pounds of ground deer this year. And, you know, I mean, that's stuff we do ourselves. And that's what, you know, goes for mom and dad, my family, my sister. We all do it together. We just set aside a night. We do that. And then, you know, and I like to give, you know, what that away to whoever will appreciate it. But I always explain to them, like, look, hey, if I cook this, you wouldn't know.
Yeah.
I promise you couldn't know. But it's because of, you know, in my opinion, the way we take care of things and the extra effort that comes into it. So, yeah, education is key in whatever it is. And so, yeah, people that just don't know or not around it, it's hard to say, you know, when the zombie deer gets posted and ran through on Facebook, you know, you just, it's hard to explain that. So, yeah, every chance you can, you got to explain to people that, hey, these are different. We want to treat them differently and we're just going to do what we can. But so far, you know, nothing has been transmissible to humans, and that's the best thing. So to this point.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I genuinely didn't know the difference in CWD and NEHD, why I brought that up. But should we, from a private landowner's perspective, should we still be, you know, encouraging people to kill as many does and get that buck to doe ratio down with EHD being so bad here lately?
I still think so. I mean, unless you're supposed, and that's the thing about EHD that's wild is, you know, it can hit 2 miles here and then over there be perfectly fine. Mm-hmm. You just don't know. And so, you know, that's where each landowner or person that's hunting that farm is going to have to make that decision of, you know, what am I seeing on my cameras? You know, what's coming into the feeders? How, you know, decimated are my food plots? Have you got an exclusion cage? You know, and then you got to make that decision of, okay, I need to take X amount of deer off this property to make things right. And then, you know, the great thing, you know, here in a lot of states have it is you can donate those deer.
Yep.
You know, you just take them out, gut them, go drop them off.
Yep.
Yeah.
I know, like talking about how it's, you know, very, each farm is a little bit different. I think I saw something on Facebook, a guy up in Northern Kentucky or Northeastern Kentucky or something, somewhere up there that was talking, he had found something like 48 deer on his farm, 48 deer on one farm, you know, and that's a severe case right there. Whereas around here, you know, you may go several farms in a row and not see a dead one. So it's crazy how it's just so secluded to each particular area. Each farm is completely different. And so management practices have to be completely different.
Yeah. And that's, yeah. And that's just the manager of the resource. That's your responsibility. So, you know, if you're the one hunting, it's just like, if these are your cows or these are my cows, it's my corn, that's your corn.
Yeah.
So, you know, every farmer, every, you know, person that's responsible for that, if that's a priority to you, you've got to determine that. And if not, you got to seek some help to find the knowledge that you need to figure out what you want it to be.
Yeah.
And what it needs to be.
Yeah. I mean, as far as LBL goes, let's say, you know, 5-10 years in advance from now, with EHD and CWD, and now the hogs are coming into play, you know, what do we need to do as hunters to be able to preserve the genetics and the really good public land deer hunting around here?
Well, we do have, with, you know, LBL and Clarks River, Big River, TVA ground, you know, whatever you say, we do have a fair amount of public land compared to a lot of places. Mm-hmm. And they're all managed differently. They're all treated differently. And that's another thing is, you know, LBL is federal. Well, they're federal, but it's a different entity. It's USDA versus National Wildlife Refuge System. Then you got, you know, some state properties as well. And so that's the hard part. They each have their own goals and they each do their own thing. And so, you know, speaking to the hogs, a good friend of mine is one of the trappers down there, mm-hmm. and they stay on them. They do. And, and the thing about hogs that people don't realize is they've never been eradicated. I don't think anywhere they've tried. And LBL is an interesting place because of the lake situation. It's possible, I guess, but it's going to take a lot of work and a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And how much is that as a priority? And obviously we want to keep that at bay best we can because they are destructive. And so, but you know, the argument is, and it's been proven, you know, I get it. A lot of the folks want to hunt them.
Yeah.
And, but it's been proven anywhere and everywhere that as soon as you give a value to that animal, you know, people want to hunt them. And then, you know, if the intentions were pure to eradicate them, and they would be happy. But, you know, what happens when we actually achieve that goal? You know, and so, you know, the fear is that people will find a value and then they will go release them mm-hmm. in that area. And that's been done by folks who, you know, enjoy hunting the hogs and in different states down in the South. And some of it was maybe not ill intent, but some of it was, we don't care. We want, this is what we like to do. So that's been the big dilemma. And then the fact of, you know, everybody acts like they would be easy to hunt. Like, hey, they're not. They're not, you know, they're out there. You know, I've seen where they're at, know where they're at. I've talked to a lot of, you know, the trappers about it. And, you know, it's like, hey, if I gave you 3 days, I don't know if you could. Now, when it's in the wintertime and they're hungry and they're on the side of the road, that's a little different.
They're smart. They're a real smart animal. They don't always appear that way.
No. And I think that is a misconception a lot of times of, you know, and yeah, you know, you might go in there and shoot one or something, but you know, the effectiveness comes in the trapping where you're able to, you know, keep those sounders together.
Yeah.
And then take out as many as you can in one lump sum versus, you know, picking them off one at a time as a hunter and then scattering them to who knows where.
That's what the biologist friend of mine, he was saying, that's the biggest thing. Like if you're out in LBL and you see one hog come by and you're deer hunting and a hog comes by and it's just all by itself. Yeah, I mean, maybe you are better off just go ahead and take that one by itself. But if generally they're going to be in a pack. So, I mean, if there's 10 of them there, you shoot one of those. Well, now you just created 9 more groups of them. Yeah. You know, you just split them up because they're that smart and you know, they know when something's not right. And so trying to trap them, like you said, is probably the most effective way if I had to guess.
Yeah. And that's just hard because, I mean, it's a big area and it's inconsistent. And, you know, you have one full-time person responsible for that with the one guy who has other responsibilities helping, you know, and you're trying to maintain, you know, and that, you know, what, you know, figure out what the population is, you know, they don't have the funds or the ability to go in there and do a thermal count, mm-hmm. you know, or get drones. I mean, they get some funds for the helicopters and that's productive. It has been, they've done a good job with that. But you know, there's just not enough. And that's the same thing, with anything these days is, you know, unfortunately wildlife doesn't get the priority or the conservation doesn't get the priority that we, as you know, outdoorsmen would like to see. Mm-hmm. And that's across the board. And, you know, I mean, that just goes from the maintenance of the roads, to, and even if those, even when the funds come in, a lot of times they don't even go directly back to mm-hmm. the public land resource, you know, has to go somewhere else and then they get allocated funds. And so it's become extremely complicated and extremely political. And that's one reason that I personally didn't go that route. You know, I know what I was able to see, you know, kind of what my dad did in the 90s. And, you know, he was out on the landscape being able to accomplish a lot of things and physically doing the things that he signed up to do. Whereas, you know, and granted, he climbed the ladder and his position changed to management to where he was confined to that desk. Mm-hmm. Answering emails, going through this, that, and the other, and then the million, you know, safety trainings and this, that, and the other to be able to just get out there and use a lawnmower, yeah. You know, and so yeah. Basic things. And so, and that, I think that goes for, you know, a lot of government agencies and a lot of, you know, cities and municipalities and all that sort of stuff. So it's gotten so complicated, bureaucratic, that efficiency is not really the model. And I think that's said about a lot of things.
Absolutely.
Yeah. They had shortened turkey season in LBL this year. Was it the hogs hurting turkey numbers on that?
No. Turkey's a separate thing. And I'll get my personal opinion is that there's really the turkey population has decreased as a result of death by a thousand cuts or whatever you want to say. You know, we've lost habitat, nesting habitat. The population of, you know, nest raiding predators has increased significantly. Nobody talks about the diseases, the amount of diseases that, you know, be it from domestic livestock or fowl or you know, maybe it's, you know, through chicken litter or any of those things. There's lots and lots going against the turkey pop, the turkeys. And so, you know, we've had some good hatches. We've had, you know, in the last 3 to 5 years better than what we had. And I think there is a slight uptick overall, but same thing. It's like, this wasn't a problem and all of a sudden it is a problem and we need to know why. Mm-hmm. But I think that it's hard to point the finger at one individual thing. I think that it's a combination of, and then figuring out, you know, is it bad enough that we do need to go to one bird?
Yeah, you know? That's true.
And so that's one of those things where we just have to figure out what makes the most sense for each of these states and how do we want to handle that population. And turkey is harder in that sense because I think it's not one specific issue or one specific problem we're addressing.
Mm-hmm. How are the turkey numbers on Clarks River?
So Clarks River, a lot of that is bottom ground, which is prime mm-hmm. turkeys. And so, you know, and Clarks River is busted up in the sense of, you know, there's a lot of private land intermingled with it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you get a lot of deer and turkeys that cross. It's not one big isolated chunk, you know, like mm-hmm. LBL. So that being the case, I think that, you know, with that being a more wetland type of refuge, which is gives, you know, turkeys, which is prime turkey habitat, the numbers are fine there. It's just more of the pressure mm-hmm. amount of people. You know, versus the way that LBL treats it, you know, with their length or shortened season rather, and their quota hunts. And so that will help. But, you know, to me is it 100% proven that it's necessary? You know, and are we, you know, do we have the information to justify shortening the season? Are we making that knee jerk reaction? Or is that, you know, just something that we visually see? Mm-hmm. So finding that balance and getting the information is hard.
Yeah. Do turkeys get the influenza, or is that just waterfowl?
Yeah, I think they can get it.
There's a lot of diseases out there for turkeys that you would probably nobody never even heard of. You know, I think, you know, there's the pox, and then there's the flu, and
I don't think like turkeys are very hardy. Like just in the grand scheme of things, like they're susceptible to a lot of different things.
Oh,
Then you know, but yeah, some of that nesting. You know, where they have the super layers, and then some who don't even try. You know, the hens, that is, some, you know, that raise majority of them, and then others don't even try to nest. It's kind of a fascinating thing. And we're starting to see a little bit of that information come out from these studies with trackers and everything. And so it'll be interesting to see. But yeah, it's like we're talking about a lot of different things, but seemingly it's like, you know, the folks who the generation before us or two generations before us, where they say, you know, I remember it was a big deal to see a deer or turkey.
Yeah.
Well, then, you know, we grew up in the prime of, hey, they're back and it's wild. Yeah. And then now we've kind of these issues. And, you know, so we've got to figure out, you know, get that information to try to do with it to just keep a reasonable population. And, you know, we may have very well seen the heyday and the golden age of whitetail and turkey be gone.
I see a lot of crossover. Obviously, I fish quite a bit as well. And I see a lot of crossover fishing and hunting. You know, we as a whole, like with bass fishing and with deer hunting, turkey hunting, I think we look at things a whole lot differently now because we understand a whole lot more. It's a lot more popular to manage. You know, we're managing whitetail, we're managing turkeys, we're managing bass fishing. You know, if someone posts a stringer of bass on Facebook, you know, they get roasted.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. And it's one of those things that I think as we know more, you know, You look at just the changes. You know, used to be just a red flannel and go out there with a rifle and sit up against a tree. And, you know, now it's so much more serious. So I think we're going to notice these changes because we're a lot more invested in it than we have over the course of several years ago. Mm-hmm. And same thing with bass fishing.
Yeah, we were talking about that with Bill Winky and on social media, how, you know, used to, if you killed a 180-inch deer, it was a huge deal. And it seems like every time you get on social media, somebody's killing up 200 here every day. And it just makes, and my social media has kind of ruined that trophy hunting aspect, I guess you could say. But yeah, I wish we could go back before social media and where, you know, it was the trophies in the eye of the beholder, or yeah, what they used to say and stuff. But
yeah, and that does create a lot of envy, and it makes people do a lot of things that they shouldn't do.
Yep.
You know, and that, you know, and social media is good what it's good for. You know, I mean, it has been a blessing to me in a lot of ways. I talked to more guys from who knows where. My wife gets so mad at me. Who's coming to our house? Yeah. Where are you going to hang out with somebody you've never met, but you're going to go spend a week with them in some state?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I appreciate it for that. But yeah, it's one of those things where you certainly have to be careful of. And, you know, the big thing now that scares me is for you know, like the next generation, our kids.
Yeah.
My 10-year-old daughter, she's, you know, ready for a phone. It's like, sorry, that's not happening.
Yeah. Yeah. And you see people with social media, you know, saying they're bow hunting and holding out for, you know, 160-inch deer, but they never even killed 130-inch deer with a bow, which could be good and bad for management and killing an older age class deer. But I think the perception out there is, you know, if you don't kill a giant, then you're just not successful or a good hunter.
Yeah. And I hate that. I mean, you know, it's you can't hunt with, you know, if it's not there, you can't kill it, you know?
Right.
And so the other thing is it's meant to be a progression, you know, whether you start in small game, you know, you start on the little duck pond, you know, you work your way up to those trips, to what you're. And so, you know, yeah, you know, go out there and you got to figure out what makes you happy. You know, it is somewhat aggravating to me, to somebody that, you know, can, you know, maybe they have enough experience that they, you know, and they say the things that they, you know, the right things, but then they continually do, you know, maybe shoot something a little smaller. It's like, you know, but in the, you know, like I said, in the end, everybody can do what they want to do, but yes, it should be a progression. You should work your way up. Like, just try to beat last year just by a little bit. And that's where I'm at, you know, with my daughter. She's killed a couple bucks now. You know, I think, you know, she started with a little 5-point, and then last year she shot a pretty decent little 9-point. So it's like, hey, you know, you can shoot whatever you want to, but, you know, for her to understand that, you know, to get something of that caliber again, it's going to take, you know, you got pretty lucky.
Yeah.
You know, we did 4 sits, and she shot a Sunday afternoon of the 2-day youth season. And so, you should build up, you should, you know, take that, and everybody's journey is different. Mm-hmm. And so, but hey, the other thing is, you know, not everybody's as serious as I am.
Yeah. Right.
And so they may be completely content with that 3-year-old every single year. And so you have to respect that. But that is what makes it hard, you know, is that everybody's goals are different. And, you know, I'm over here trying to accomplish this, and they're trying to accomplish this, and we're neighbors, and that doesn't match. And so, you know, you just got to figure out where that balance is.
That's the thing. I like to manage deer to try and shoot mature deer, because that's my goal. But I hate, like, talking about social media, I hate seeing these posts where someone will shoot a smaller deer or younger deer, and people are shaming them for that. You know, I mean, I saw something one time that was about Fred Bear. It was like, well, Fred Bear wasn't too good to shoot a little deer, you know? And so whatever floats your boat. I mean, and we're all able to do whatever we want to do. I want to manage deer. If you want to shoot smaller deer or younger deer, that's fine, but realize that you're not going to get that mature deer, that bigger deer, you know, if you don't let it go.
Yeah. And that's just the thing. It's like, you got those keyboard warriors and, you know, so this, that, and the other. So as long as somebody's happy and they're following the rules, that's all you can do in the end.
Yeah.
So if you shoot a 2-year-old, you shoot a 3-year-old, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
As long as you're following the rules and you're doing what you're supposed to do, you're treating it with respect. You know, I don't care. You know,
that's what I want to see the industry be, is everybody get along with everybody and just enjoy the harvest, you know, whatever that harvest is, just be able to enjoy that.
If only.
Yeah, it'd be nice.
Yeah, we talked about gun season, but what's your thoughts on crossbow? Do you think there should be a separate crossbow season?
I do like the way that they've done it, where you cannot, you know, start using a crossbow till after the first 2 weeks in September, and then same thing in January. The hard part is they are so effective, and I've got some friends that are able-bodied 30-year-old men that should not be using them, and I give them a lot of grief.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's just, you know, but that's the way it goes. And so it does provide more opportunity, and that's the thing. That balance of, okay, we are now so much more technologically advanced and so much more efficient versus the old school days of what the primitive weapons were. And so finding that balance is, but, you know, the other thing is, you know, if hunter numbers are truly declining, which I don't know, I see so many people these days.
I don't see how that's true.
I don't know how, but that was always the thing for a long time. So finding the balance of how much public land do we have? Is it enough to support this? You know, and then, you know, giving the opportunity for folks. And so it wouldn't bother me if it was, if it was its own season, maybe for the 9th of November or just a little bit longer. It doesn't have to be as long as it is now. Of course, in every state treats that differently. You know, Iowa, you're going to have a disabled permit or a doctor's note or whatever you want to call it to be able to use one outside of I'm assuming gun season or whatever the way that works. I don't know. But it's hard. I'm not going to go against it because it does provide, like, my kids. Like, I'm still hoping to have an opportunity to take my daughter, you know, maybe the end of October one afternoon or just when I can, and she'll be able to use a crossbow, or my wife, if I can get her to get go again, you know. So it does provide opportunity that I like. And so I'm not hard against it, but, you know, it definitely needs to be, in my opinion, you know, regulated at least a little bit.
Yeah. Do you you ever get a chance to go out west and hunt mule deer or elk or anything?
So I've been to Colorado once. We did, that was a glorified hiking trip. We did an over-the-counter elk hunt. That's what that was. But I've done Wyoming mule deer once. That was I didn't draw Colorado. So when I found that out, I had 3 or 4 days to make a decision because Wyoming was still open. So I just threw a pin at the or dart at the map, drew a region mule deer tag, and I think I drove 19 hours by myself and stayed for 9 days and camped and slept. And I missed a really good one on the first morning. And I didn't know what I was, I mean,
didn't know.
I mean, yeah, I mean, I had a region, so I had some space, but you know, I ended up finding some, I saw some really good ones, and then I ended up wounding one. A couple days later, that was significantly smaller. He'd probably been 140, but I was tickled for the experience. And but you know, gut shot mule deer in the middle of dark timber does not add up, you know, very well. I tried, I backed out, and then grid searched the next day best I could. And of course, I had really nothing to go off of. So I've done a few things. I did we tried a antelope hunt out in western Nebraska one year. Went to New Zealand and shot a stag last year, and so I did Alaska caribou in 21. That was fun, interesting. I've never been so wet in my life. There's nothing to burn. There's no way to get dry. The one thing I remember about that is I was mowing my yard here. It was August. I think we left the 15th of August, and they should have been right out of velvet by the time we got up there. But I was mowing my yard, didn't have a shirt on. I'm dripping in sweat. It's 101. Our folks who drop service, she called, and she's like, "Hey, you need to pack for snow." It's 101 out. I can't in my mind pack for snow right now.
Yeah.
But you know, being able to get up there and go the length of the haul road, you know, that's, and so that's when now it's like, I mean, I'm still, whitetails are number one, but the way I try to approach it is, you know, I'm still driving the truck out there that I drove today from high school.
Yeah.
I do have a nicer truck, but that's, I mean, I put my miles on that one. Mm-hmm. And so everybody always says, it's, you know, it's like, hey, y'all make truck payments, I make hunt payments.
Yeah.
So I stash it away. And then every second or third year, I'll save up enough to where I can determine, you know, and like the Western trips, if you know, if you do your research, you buy your points and you're willing to go out there, you know, you can do those hunts for reasonably cheap over the counter, not over the counter, but public land, do those things. And then, you know, there's some hunts, whether it's Africa or New Zealand or Spain or, you know, some of those like that, you're just going to have to save up and set it aside. And so I try to do those every third year. And in between, I'll do a Kansas and Iowa and a, you know, maybe I'll sneak in a Wyoming, you know, public land hunt, something like that. So I'm definitely trying to just mix it up, do what I can. And then, you know, the turkeys, I don't get too far on turkeys. I think last year I did Indiana, Ohio, and Illinois. And just
that was going to be my question. If you'd done the slam or anything?
No, I have to prioritize. And with real estate, March, April, May is the gauntlet. And so when I did like Ohio and Indiana, that was a 3-day trip. I went some private with some friends that invited me up. And so Illinois, of course, I can make that day drive. So I just have to, that's one of those things where deer are more important. So that's where I sacrifice. One day I'll make the big tour and cover some ground. But you know, right now I just put it into whitetails, and I like to make, and the way I've done it or try to do it, especially now as the kids have gotten older, and I really have to set aside, like I haven't, like outside the kids, I haven't even been this year. I don't, you know, it's been extremely busy. Mm-hmm. And so the way I try to approach it is, you know, one in September, if I can get it, maybe that's a Western hunt, you know, a week in November, which will be some Midwestern rut state. And then the time that I go that a lot of people don't is when it's really cold. And I like to go, you know, late season somewhere, either Missouri or Iowa usually. And then I'll do that late season muzzleloader hunt when it's real cold. Then there's a lot less happening. You know, once Christmas is over, you know, maybe around the first of the year, that first 2 weeks of January where people are still kind of getting back in and it's not as busy, that's a real good window. So I've kind of, and those are far enough apart that it doesn't make my wife too mad. I can space them out.
Yeah.
I can space them out.
About time she forgives you for the last one.
Yeah, exactly.
Time to go on
exactly.
The next one.
So I'm approaching it that way.
Yeah.
That's been the model. And I think it's been working pretty well.
Yeah. That caribou hunt would be a dream of mine. Was it just sitting up top glassing all day?
No, it was, I could see further than I could walk. You know, we were on the tundra. It was as flat as could be.
Okay.
I mean, it wasn't flat. There was a little bit of rise, but still, you know, you'd walk a mile to just look over there and it's like, hey, there's some over there. Well, that's three more miles.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they flew us in on a float plane, mm-hmm. dropped us off. And then we were there for 6 days until we finally shot them and they come got us. And so, not something I'd probably do again. That was my 30th birthday trip that I wanted to do and decided on that year or a couple of years prior. So that was that experience. But, you know, it's one of those things like it was fun. It was wet. I kept thinking, you know, we'd get dry. We'd build a fire. There's nothing to burn. It's a tundra.
Yeah.
And so it's like, you know, and then you get wet. It was so wet. And so we missed a good portion of the migration. We didn't really. And that's the thing. It's so hit and miss. Mm-hmm. Some, you know, if you can get dropped right in the middle of them, we got dropped behind it. Come to find out, you know, we learned later that, hey, they had already left. We were too far north. We were behind them. But, you know, it's one of those things. It's you know, experience. And we both shot bulls, but they were small.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, the elk hunting quota thing, I guess you could say the preference points kind of confuse me. Because, I mean, to get a really good track and area with, like trophy class bulls, I mean, you would have to put in for what, 20 years?
Yeah, and that just depends on the state and how much money you want to spend.
Yeah.
And so I personally, at this point in life, have decided that I'll just pay. I'll save up. Mm-hmm. And I might do, it's like, Wyoming is the state where I've built up the most. So one day when I cash those in, I may have 12, 15, 20. That'll probably be the once in a lifetime kind of deal. And I may do some other hunts with lower expectations, but to have the true, you know, what you see on TV experience, you know, you got to be on private. There's just no way around it. You've got to find those ranches. You know, unless you live out there, you know, it's like we can do what we do with whitetails. You know, if I've mentioned all these states where we can drive and spend a weekend and do this and do that and scout and have, you know, quality opportunities. Just like I leave cameras soaking in two or three different states on public to just know what's going to be there for next year.
Yeah.
You know, and with really no intention anywhere. Whereas out west, if you live out there, they can do the same thing.
Yeah.
So for a Midwesterner, if you don't have the funds or the connections, you know, that's my opinion. So one day I'll do it. You know, I think mule deer, my big fear getting out there later in the year, October, November, is just being in those mountains when the snow comes down or getting caught up there and just not having that experience. You know, it's not something we get to do or know how to handle very often. And you're driving up down these roads. So that's why for me, I'm pretty comfortable being out there in September.
Yeah.
How many preference points is it a year you get? Is it two?
It's one per state, you know, and every state is different. You know, it's like, it's so complicated. Whereas Wyoming is a true straight preference point state. Whereas you get into Montana, you can buy your base preference points. You can only have up to two or three before they take them away if you don't apply. If you apply, but you know, once you have two, you should draw. I think or three, you should draw. That's for their big game combo. But then they have bonus points. And then bonus points go into the pool where you can, they're squared, and then that can add you into some special areas. And so you get into other states like Idaho and New Mexico, that's completely random. There are no preference points. And so it's very, very complicated, very different. And, you know, like if you want to watch Randy Newberg, he explains it on his YouTube videos, you know, just saying this state this year, he has a breakdown of, okay, this is what you need to do. This is so some states I've built points in. And, you know, if you look at, if I buy elk, mule deer, and antelope, and I do that for Wyoming, Colorado, Utah, well, I get one trip per year, so I might burn them, cash them in on mule deer 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I may not be back to that state for 10. And by then, if I've built up that many more elk points, so it's hard for a Midwestern guy to get out there and actually use all those points. But if you don't have them the way point creep is in today, and so it's money that's probably thrown out the window in a lot of cases, but you got to have them or you'll never even have the opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you ever put in for the non-resident Kansas turkey tag?
No, I have not. I know that Eastern side, they reduced their tag. They had some flooding a few years back. It was pretty bad and wrecked a lot of the nesting. So I haven't made it any further west than Missouri as far as turkeys go.
Okay.
I've kind of stayed on this side where the true east. As a matter of fact, I've only killed Easterns. But, you know, I think I did shoot 5 this year. So, a good year.
Yeah. I put in for it and didn't get drawn this year. So, I'll be shocked if I don't get drawn again next year for turkeys, which is weird. I would have figured I got drawn for turkeys, but not for deer my first time. But it was the other way around.
Yeah. And I think like on the eastern half, it's like 50% draw without a point and then 50%, you know, anyways, but they have a breakdown where you can get on there and see the odds. And then of course, Go Hunt is a good, you know, there's some other ones, but the Go Hunt's the one I use for odds as far as percentages and knowing, but both skip a year. I mean, I drew in 21 for Kansas with deer, but anyways, I had a point each time. Every year I put in without a point. I'm not the lucky one.
Yeah.
Didn't you kill an Oklahoma deer a couple of years ago?
Yeah, I did. So. A buddy of mine who tried to outfit, he picked up some lease and was going to see if he could sell some hunts and that sort of thing. And so I had helped him out and we worked a deal. So I went out there and that one, I don't know, that deer's probably 30s. He was maybe 4. Yeah. Doesn't really matter because that hunt there, that was a spot and stalk on the ground. Northwest Oklahoma, they had, you know, some corn piles and some blinds. We'd been seeing some deer, but I told him, I was like, you know, man, I just really, if there's an opportunity, I really want to spot and stalk one. And so that deer was earlier in November, but I just sat up on the ground in a cedar bush. I was on this side of the creek. The deer walks on the far side of the creek, and this is in scrub brush country. And actually, I was behind him, but I was being aggressive. I was just seeing what I could do. Like, I had nothing to lose. And so I got up behind him, and I crawled. And I was probably 50 yards from him, behind him. And he's just moseying along. And he heard me. And he actually wondered. He was trying to figure out what I was. He actually turned back to me and came closer with that with that head up, just trying to look, like, trying to figure out what exactly it was. I'm laying there on the ground with an arrow knocked like this. And when he did that, he turned. You know, he turned and he got broadside, and then I just came up and shot him, and that one was pretty awesome. I end up letting him bed. We went and ate breakfast, came back, and actually found him still alive, and then snuck. He was hurt real bad, but I snuck in there and was able to get another one in on him, and that was if you can spot stalk it, I mean, that's
get the adrenaline going.
That way, and like I said, I mean, there's nothing more I love than watching a good old whitetail adrenaline DVD. I don't know if y'all
are familiar. Oh, yeah. But
that there, that's top of the line right there.
Yeah.
I keep waiting on the next one.
How are you, were you stalking on a decoy or just straight up?
Just straight up being not smart about it and got lucky, because there's no reason I should have been able to get that close to a deer that I was behind, but just fortunate. And he was being, you know, curious as to what was going on, and you know, I just happened to play it right. And you know, for that reason, it's one of the most fun hunts I have ever had, you know, but regardless of how big it was. I mean, and it was a great deer. I mean, I was super, you know, excited to have that one. So that was a really fun hunt for sure.
Yeah. Well, we're creeping in on about an hour here. Tell us where they can find you on social media, website, all that good stuff.
Yeah. Well, Reese Johnson 7 on pretty much about any platform. I used to be a lot more involved in that than I am now. I've kind of gone through the burnout phase, but I still like to talk to people. Anybody have any questions or anything, or whether it be real estate or just deer, you know, I love talking. So anything I can help with, you're welcome to send me a message.
Trail Camera Tuesday. Yep. Is it coming back?
Claim to fame. No, it's over.
Over.
I'm too old. Too old. I mean, every once in a while, but
yeah,
you know, back before the algorithms and you could do things.
Yeah.
So I'll let it be. I'll let the next generation have it. But it was fun while it lasted. And, you know, like I said, I mean, got to meet a lot of folks and do a lot of cool things because of it. So
sure.
Don't regret it.
Good deal. You got anything else, Ryan?
That's it. That wraps it up.
Good deal. Well, we appreciate you joining us, and we'll see you on the next one.
Is that it?